Time and again I thought of the American soldier who had been so kind to me. Just before he had driven off, he had said that he would see me again. With a chill, I recalled that the fighting had gone on after I had spoken to him. Something might have happened to him. A week passed. One afternoon, an American came in and glanced into each bunk. My eyes met his as he approached. "It's you I'm looking for," he said. I must have frowned as I recognized him. Out of his helmet and battle gear, he looked different. "Don't you remember me?" he asked. "Oh, yes," I said quickly, and wanted to add how worried I had been that something might have befallen him, but checked myself. He carried a parcel under his arm. "These are for you," he said, unwrapping two magazines. "Do you know what this means?" he asked, pointing to four bold white letters on a red background. I gazed at the letters. L-I-F-E. He repeated his question. "Do you know what it means?"
"It is a fine word for you to learn. I know no better word of introduction to the English language for you."
I pronounced the word and tasted the strange sound of it.
"Say it again," he urged.
I was only too glad to try.
"That's right, that's what I wanted to see."
"To see what?" I asked.
"You smiled," he said. "I wanted to see you smile."
We talked. He told me that he had been busy with large numbers of prisoners, and that was why he had not come sooner. He said that he was stationed in a neighboring village about 16 miles away. We talked like old friends. There was so much to ask. He seemed amazed at the limited knowledge I had about the development of the war. His German was excellent, though not fluent. At times he substituted an English word for a German one, but I nearly always knew what he meant. The nurse came in, bringing my dinner tray, and told him that all visitors had to leave. I would have gladly foregone food if he could have stayed. He left, and I ate my dinner, realizing that I had again forgotten to ask his name. After eating, until the light grew too poor, I studied the magazines. The pictures of the free world were exciting. Then, unexpectedly, a voice near me said, "Hello," in English.
"You're not going to throw me out, are you?"
I was overjoyed to see him. It hadn't occurred to me that he might return in the evening. This time I learned his name.
"Kurt Klein," he said, laughing. "By the way, I wrote the letter to your uncle in Turkey. I hope I can bring you an answer soon."
I told Kurt about the strange sensation I felt every time I saw German soldiers under guard. "Just hurry up and get well," he said, "and I'll show you how many of them are under guard." And he told me some of his experiences with the Germans' surprise when they heard about their concentration camps.
"It seems we fought a war against the Nazis, but I haven't met a Nazi yet," he said wryly.
And I was actually able to laugh. He could make me laugh, but I was ashamed to cry in front of him. I told him about Ilse. He seemed to understand. He didn't tell me to forget, to draw a line through the past, for he knew that I couldn't. He didn't ask questions, either. He listened to what I had to tell him. He was silent when he knew that there was no answer. He joked about the present, and again I found myself laughing. His daily visits continued. Although we came from different worlds, we understood each other. I did not want pity. I did not want him to like me because of what I had endured. Without knowing why, I sensed that there was something in his past that made him suffer. A couple of days after his first visit, he brought me some lilies of the valley. The subtle fragrance brought back memories of my garden in May. I clutched the flowers without being able to speak. I remembered the roses in Grünberg, which we had not been allowed to touch. But here were flowers that bloomed for me. I kept my eyes downcast for quite a while, not daring to raise them and have them full of tears. Finally, Kurt asked, "Do you like them?" My answer must have been written on my face. There was a catch in his voice when he spoke.
"I knew you would. They were my mother's favorite flowers."
"Your mother?"
I asked haltingly.
Then for the first time Kurt told me about himself. He had been born in Germany. His older sister had gone to America soon after Hitler came to power, Kurt following her a year later. Finally, the older brother had left for America. The parents had stayed behind. With their children safe, they waited, hoping that the Nazi regime would collapse. I remembered when Mama and Papa had talked the same way. Kurt went on to tell me how the children's combined efforts had failed to get their parents out of Germany. The Nazis deported them to Camp de Gurs in the south of France in 1941. For a while, letters reached them from America. Then in July 1942, a letter had been returned, stamped, moved, left no forwarding address. Kurt fell silent. I understood so well. Impulsively, I caught his hand.
There is hope still, I said.
Is there? His voice was slightly ironical, but there was some concealed hope in it. I had always felt that his understanding of my feelings had been made deeper by a tragedy of his own. I was glad now that I had never given him detailed descriptions of cruelty, that I had never really told him what had happened, though he heard it from others later. Yet the knowledge that I could shield him from pain gave me satisfaction. The days went on. Physically, I felt worse and worse. I tried to conceal it, even from the nurses and doctors. In the hours when Kurt was not with me, I read the German books he brought and studied the American magazines. Then I began to observe that most of the girls around me were better and were allowed to get up. Some girls moved into private homes, and I marveled at their courage and ingenuity. How did they manage? I continually asked for Liesel and was finally told that she had died after an amputation. I was alone again. None of my close friends remained. Again and again, the burning question came back. What do I do from now on? Sometimes I woke from sleep, covered with perspiration, feeling as though someone had shaken me and shouted, "What now?" into my ear. I fell exhausted into my pillows. Sometimes I cried silently or tossed for hours until a nurse mercifully gave me a sleeping pill. The first possibility that ran through my mind would be to go home. Perhaps Papa and Mama, perhaps Arthur, but I knew they would not be there. Then I must go home alone. If nothing else, there would be the house, the garden. Perhaps Nyanya had saved a few things. And then there was Abek. I really had not thought about him until now, and when I did, I became panicky. Why was I so afraid? Then there was my uncle in Turkey. He would surely make me welcome. Yet he and his wife and children lived in a world so remote from mine that I did not think that I could be happy there in it. Lastly, if these alternatives failed, I would go to Palestine. One day after Kurt left, while leafing through a magazine he had just brought, I found an envelope between the pages. It was sealed and had my name on it in pencil in a corner. For a few seconds, fear gripped me. Was he being transferred, and was this his way of telling me? I tore the envelope open. There was no letter in it, just several banknotes. I was touched by his thought. God knows I needed money, for I owned nothing, but I felt I could not accept it. When Kurt came the next day, I told him that he had forgotten something. "You are not angry?" he asked. "Please do take it. Consider it a loan. Pay it back to me. If I should have to leave unexpectedly, I would like to know that you have some means to buy the bare necessities and to get home." He worried about me. Though I felt deeply grateful and could have accepted the money from a stranger, I could not receive it from him. "I can't," I whispered, and he argued no further. About that time, Herr Nabel, the owner of the factory in which we were hiding on Liberation Day, started making daily visits to all the girls in the hospital. When I told him my name and where I came from, he told me that he had known either my father or one of his business associates. The following day, his two daughters, young married women whose husbands were in Allied hands, came to visit me. The day after that, they came again and brought me a dress. It is hard to describe the joy that I felt and the eagerness with which I looked forward to being able to get up and wear it. I know that I will never feel the same way toward any garment, no matter what its value or beauty, as I felt toward that simple cotton dress. Everyone in the hospital knew Kurt by now. He was commonly referred to as Goethe's lieutenant. Everyone joked about us. He was undoubtedly the most faithful visitor to the hospital, although none of the girls really understood our relationship. It was pointed out to me many times that he was a fool if he did not provide the clothing and food which I needed, and which he as an American could obtain, and that I was an even greater fool for not asking him. I shrugged it off, for I had the feeling that my real reasons would not be understood. Kurt instinctively knew my needs. By not bringing me clothes, he made me feel that he did not see my pitiful need of them, that I appeared to him as a normal girl briefly confined to a hospital. His gifts of flowers or reading material were appropriate. Thus he helped me to gain confidence in myself as a human being. One day, checking the thermometer the nurse had given me, I confirmed my suspicion that I had a high fever. Since I was expecting Kurt, and I was afraid that I might not be permitted to have a visitor, I shook the thermometer down and handed it to the nurse when she returned. Kurt came, and he was ill at ease. Then he told me that he was being transferred to Falkirchen in Bavaria, about 300 kilometers distant. He showed me some pictures of himself that had just been taken. I wanted one, but could not overcome my shyness to ask for it. I looked at one in particular many times. Finally, he asked me if I wanted it. "Yes," I admitted, "very much." "Why on earth didn't you tell me?" Then an idea struck me. "Go out into the corridor and write something on it. I have a surprise for you, too," I said. As he did, I called a nurse who had been particularly kind to me all the time. "I want to get up. I must get up," I told her. "The doctor won't let you," she said. "You are not strong enough." "I have to. I have to." I was close to tears. The nurse helped me down from my bed, helped me put on the cotton dress that the neighbor girls had given me. Slowly I crept toward the door. Kurt gasped when he saw me. "This is a surprise indeed," he said, and he took my arm. The shape of the corridor seemed queer. The echo of voices, the click of trays, the hurrying nurses bothered me. The sounds were metallic, falling on the stone walls and coming back to my ears with a strange edge to them. Kurt let me out a side door into what had been the schoolyard. We walked slowly, each step causing me pain. I remembered Hans Christian Andersen's tale about the mermaid who was in love with a prince. She had a witch sell her a brew that would change her fins into legs so that she might for once walk with the prince. She had her wish, but the price was a steep one, for each step she took she felt as if she were stepping on knives. "Kurt, do you remember the Andersen fairy tales?" I asked. "Some," he answered. "Why?" At this point, I decided that it was best not to tell him and started to laugh. I changed the subject. I don't remember what we talked about. The time went fast. Kurt wanted to take me indoors and see me safely to bed before he left. I objected. I did not want to say goodbye to him with all the girls around us. The lights would be on inside. I did not want him to see the tears that would start at the thought of my being alone again. He did not argue, but walked me as far as the entrance and gave me the picture. I knew it was up to me to say something. I said it very quickly, afraid that my voice might break. "I want to thank you for everything you have done. I shall never forget it as long as I live." Kurt took both my hands and held them. "All I can say is, I shall see you as soon and as much as I can." Then he turned and walked away quickly. Once in my bunk I started to cry. I cried because there was nothing to look forward to,
Kurt would not come, I might never see him again. I heard Ida, a simple girl with a shrill voice, call out, "You know, girls, Gerda is crying because her lieutenant left." Someone else said, "Don't be a fool, Gerda. You knew he would leave sooner or later. Did you think he would take you with him?" I fumbled in my dress and took out Kurt's picture. On the back it said, "To Gerda, at the start of a new life." The inscription was in English, but I understood it completely. The night was never ending. I tossed around, my throat was parched, my temples throbbed furiously. When the night nurse came, she felt my hand. "Why, you're burning," she exclaimed. After checking my pulse, she disappeared, almost instantly returning with a doctor. I was undressed and wrapped in a cold, wet sheet. I lost consciousness. Days passed. Sometimes I did not really feel ill, though I knew that I must be. My temperature remained high. I slept most of the time, or was semi-conscious. One afternoon I opened my eyes to find a nurse peering at me. "Oh, you're awake at last," she said, holding ice water to my lips. "How good, how refreshing." Then I saw Kurt. He was smiling at me. After the nurse left, he took my hand. My bony fingers felt at peace in that cool, strong hand. I lay there happy and tired. Kurt's voice was softly teasing. "What's the idea? The minute I turn my back, you get yourself sick." The scolding felt good. I smiled. I learned that I had been sick a week. "I'm quite excited," Kurt said. "Just before I came here today, I got a letter from my sister in New York. I'm going to become an uncle. They didn't let me know before. I wonder what Barbara will have to say." "And who is Barbara?" I asked. "My niece, of course." He pulled a picture out of his pocket. I looked at a little girl with pigtails in a light dress and sweater, a child of about 3 years of age. I had learned to associate children with death. Children were not permitted to live, to laugh. This child was standing among trees. "What is she doing with that flower?" I asked, to mask my emotions. "That's not a flower, that's a lollipop." I did not understand the word. Kurt tried to say it in German and finally made it clear. "Let me look at the lollipop again," I said, ashamed to tell him that I wanted to see the child. Barbara had a special place in Kurt's heart, and he delighted in telling me about her, about a game called Make Like a Birdie, which he had taught her. He would hold her in his arms and fly around the room, much to the alarm of his sister. I could see Kurt holding that child in his arms, laughing and enjoying the game as much as the child did. Another picture sprang to my mind. Abek talking about his little niece, full of love, too, yes, but with sadness. I could never picture Abek so fully enjoying and sharing the child's play, laughing with her, being so happy. Before I could check myself, the words tumbled out. "I wish that I had a little niece or a little baby." "You," Kurt said, using for the first time the German du instead of sie, "you are just a silly little girl yourself, not much older or bigger than Barbara." It felt wonderfully good and peaceful to be thought of as a little girl, a silly little girl with no worries or problems. With Kurt's hands still holding mine, I drifted off to a strength-giving sleep. I felt much better the next morning, although my temperature was still up. I asked for paper and pencil. The nurse brought them to me, and I began to make a drawing of the flowers that Kurt had brought me. Kurt found me at this project when he called. He had spent the night in Vollery, but now had to return to Pfarrkirchen. 5 hours' ride by jeep. He left around noon, promising to come again as soon as he could get away. The doctors told me that I had come through both pneumonia and typhus, and that I was now out of danger. However, there seemed to be some complications about my feet. I still had no strength in them, and I knew that beneath the bandages they were not healing properly. Sometimes the doctor who had most to do with me would find time for a chat. He was Austrian. It was never clear to me if he had been in the German army. We spoke about other things. Once he said he would like to write a medical book about concentration camps, about the body and mind under conditions of extreme duress. He asked me if I would help him. I said, of course, rather looking forward to contributing my experiences. He seemed vitally interested in people's minds. One particular evening he asked me again and again how much I thought a mind could stand. I knew he was driving at something. Then, very subtly, he told me that he had had to operate on a number of girls with frozen limbs. As he spoke, he watched me. I knew he was speaking about me. Never, I shouted. He had expected resistance. There was sympathy in his eyes and determination. I have been told many times in my life that I have an instinctive approach to a situation. It happened at that moment, too. From the medical viewpoint, amputation of my feet must have been right, or it would not have been proposed, but I had greater faith in my own judgment. We don't have to do it right away, the doctor continued, but I wanted you to have the thought in mind in case there is no improvement. Before he went home that night, the doctor came again to see me. I hardly recognized him in civilian clothes, having seen him only in white. Tomorrow, he said, we shall try something. His voice was impersonal. We will bathe your feet alternately in hot water and cold water. It may be very painful. Perhaps you know better. The treatment started. The hot water was boiling hot. The cold water was ice water. At first there was not much sensation. Later the hot and the cold were equally excruciating, but I rejoiced in the pain, for it meant that I had life in my legs, that I would be able to walk. Kurt came again, bringing me roses. He was glad to see me recovering so fast. Next day, noting that my temperature was up, my doctor laughed and remarked, "Nothing like being in love to raise one's temperature." In love, in love. I tasted the sound of the words and liked them, yet I knew that it was not that simple, even though I cared deeply for Kurt. One of the nurses had given me a little mirror, and I began to use it more and more. My hair was by now back to its original black. As I combed it daily, it felt thicker, and the natural wave returned to it. My cheeks filled out. The dimples that I used to have reappeared. "You look different, Goethe," the girls told me. "My, what a man at your bedside can't do." I hardly recognized myself. My sallowness was gone. My eyes looked lively rather than tragic. Involuntarily, I smiled. I looked younger than my 21 years. Kurt had told me that, too. He said, "When I first met you, you looked 40. Now you're back to 16. That's not fair." He laughed, and I joined in. I was happy and young and gay when he was with me, and I tried not to think of anything else. I was happy for the moment. That was all that mattered. In the course of conversation, I learned that his birthday would fall on a Sunday, his day to visit me. The previous Sunday, I was allowed to get up and take my first steps alone. I planned to take a walk with Kurt when he came, and as a present, I wrote a few short essays for him. I told him in advance about the walk we would be taking. Starting Wednesday, I practiced hard. I actually had to learn to walk again. The first steps were difficult and frightening. I felt dizzy and longed for bed, but I walked first to the adjacent bed, then to the window, to the door, then once around the room, twice around the room. Finally, I ventured into the corridor. By Saturday, I hesitatingly tried the stairs. Sunday came, and I was ready. Kurt usually came in the morning. He started from Farkirchen at daybreak to arrive around 11, but this was a special Sunday. I watched the door each time it opened. Lunchtime came, and no sign of Kurt. I watched from the window, my heart beating faster as each jeep approached. The noon hour passed. Perhaps he could not get away, I thought. I went out into the yard behind the hospital. I heard another jeep approach. I thought I would stay a while before returning to my room. Although Kurt knew I would be up today, he would be surprised to find my bed empty. I counted to 500, then went inside. Kurt was not there. I asked the girl in the bed next to mine. No, Kurt had not been there. I could not stand it. I'm going for a walk, I stammered. Across from the hospital was a meadow. I had yearned to walk in it for weeks, and so I left the hospital and headed for it. A group of people approached as I crossed the street. I had the desire to run away and found myself instinctively panic-stricken about the absence of my Jewish star. I sat down on a slope under a pine tree and tried to think of my new freedom, but all my thoughts were of Kurt. Why did he not come? A new fear gripped me. Could he have been sent to Japan? No, this couldn't be. He would have come to say goodbye. Then, all of a sudden, it seemed clear. Today, for the first time, I was to walk. That was all that Kurt wanted to achieve. In his kindness, he wanted to help me get well. But once I was well... Perhaps the whispers and jokes about us had reached his ears. The girls and nurses were constantly saying that we were in love. I searched my heart and came to the conclusion that I cared deeply for Kurt in a silent, suppressed way. Why should I not? I asked myself. He was kind, understanding, intelligent, and handsome. There was an aura of heroism about him. He had liberated me. He was, for me, the incorporation of freedom and understanding. Why should I not love him? Yet how did Kurt feel about me? He liked me, I knew that. Why else would he come hundreds of miles to see me? He wanted to help me, but what did he think about me as a girl? That I did not know. I certainly couldn't look pretty to him. I recalled the pictures of beautiful American girls in the magazines he had brought me. Those were the girls he knew. Surely I could never compare with those girls. Besides, he must always remember me the way I looked when he met me, more like an animal than a human being. He is kind not to come again. It is probably for the best. Yet the thought that I might never see him again became unbearable. One thing I resolved. If I saw him again, he would never know my feelings for him. I would never be a burden for him. And then I realized that he might be married or engaged. He had never said... I returned to the hospital utterly miserable. I just could not believe that on the first day out of bed I could feel so sad and forlorn. The girls teased me, good-naturedly, but it hurt. Monday came. The week crept slowly by. Saturday, Sunday. I waited, I hoped, but Kurt didn't come, nor did he send word. The Nables took great interest in me. They invited me for dinner frequently and even asked me to stay in their home. I considered doing so, but since I was not yet discharged from the hospital or strong enough to work for my room and board, I declined. One day I found Mrs. Von Garnier, one of the daughters, sewing a new dress for me, a really beautiful silky thing with fine stripes of navy and deep pink. Simple in style, with a tiny white collar, it looked really elegant. Even the new dress did not give me any joy. Kurt would not see it, and I could not pay for it. It was charity, and I hated charity. I told Mrs. Von Garnier my feelings. "You must not feel it's charity," she said. "Perhaps you can help us some day."
"Help you? How?"
"Well," she did not finish. I wondered what was behind her remarks. The Nables had a well-stocked library. I borrowed books by the armful, and at the hospital I often read late into the night. I should have been happy. I was free, not hungry, although most of the time I could have eaten more. Food was by no means plentiful yet. I was free of lice, had a clean bed to sleep in, and books to read. Yet, and I would never have believed it possible, I was not happy. For I was sure now that I should not see Kurt again. As the other girls put it, it was time to look for a new boyfriend. They were plentiful. A whole American division was stationed in the area. But I wanted to speak to no one. My thoughts were constantly with Kurt. I worried about his safety. Perhaps he had caught my typhus. I woke up one night with that terrible thought. I could have inquired about him from the local military government, but pride prevented me from seeking him out. I knew I had to wait. The weekend was approaching again. In the almost 3 weeks that I hadn't seen Kurt, I had come to hate weekends. On Friday evening, a captain from the military government brought me Kurt's letter. The captain chatted for a while, and I tried to make polite conversation, but my thought was of the envelope in my hand. Was it goodbye? I tore it open. A dry flower fell out. No, that was not goodbye. The letter was dated June 27, 1945. It had taken almost 3 weeks to reach me. Kurt could not write to me directly. Civilians weren't allowed to receive mail yet. His letter had come through official channels. It was a long letter, starting with the thought that I could not get rid of him easily. The army, he explained, had abruptly transferred him to a distant town near Munich. He teased me about my first walk, wrote gaily about his environment and about his few days of leave which he had used to visit the Austrian Alps. The letter continued with the hope that I would write to him through the same channels. There was a postscript. I picked this alpine rose for you at 2,500 meters. I read the letter again and again, relieved that my fears had been unfounded, and that I would have more letters to look forward to. And perhaps, as Kurt had written, I would see him again in the not-too-distant future. Chapter 3. The next day, Saturday, I spent with the Nabals. Lunch was served out in the garden under a sprawling tree. The modest fare seemed luxurious to me, and I enjoyed the sparkling silver and fine china, the beautiful tablecloth and the floral centerpiece quite as much. That luncheon was particularly good, and I remember it vividly. There were fried potatoes, yogurt, and a big salad. For dessert there were field strawberries and the cream that had been removed from the yogurt. And with Kurt's letter in my pocket, the world looked rosy again. After lunch, I took a long sunbath in a deck chair. At first, I read, then I tried to think about the future, but pushed the thoughts away. The afternoon was too perfect. After a bit, I fell asleep. I woke up feeling chilled. The sun was no longer shining. Heavy clouds hung in the sky. The gusts of wind were howling through the trees. I ran toward the house. As I approached it, the first raindrops fell. I had always liked rain, and I watched it now from the library window. Soon the gutters were rushing little rivers. Here and there leaves floated on the streams. I watched them journey. "Miss Goethe," Mrs. von Garnier called, "your dress is ready. Don't you want to try it on?" I tried it on before the mirror in her bedroom. The lines were simple, and it fitted beautifully. It showed my new tan to advantage and made me appear healthier than I was. I kept the dress on and went back to the library. It was close to 6 o'clock when the rain finally stopped, and we decided to go back to the hospital. I was saying goodbye to our hosts when the doorbell rang. The maid opened the door, and there stood Kurt. Not even in my dreams had I expected to see him so soon. His raincoat and helmet were dripping. His uniform looked wet through and through. "I looked for you in the hospital all over," he said. "God, have you changed? And that dress? Are you still going to talk to me?" I laughed. Kurt had traveled for 8 hours or more in an open jeep in the pouring rain over partially destroyed roads, and he could stay only until noon the next day, for he had to be back in Munich by night. The Nabals invited him to dinner and to spend the night. He declined the dinner, but said that he would gladly accept lodgings, since it would be difficult to find others. We left for the hospital. The air was sweetly scented after the rain. Heavy drops hung in the leaves. After my supper at the hospital, we returned to Herr Nabals. Only the younger daughter was present. The elder and the father had gone out. Kurt was shown to his room while I waited in the living room. The windows were open, the evening was slightly chilly, and the fragrance of flowers drifted into the room. The furniture was old, dark, polished mahogany with brown leather upholstery. The room was quiet and orderly. The house had survived the war without change. I touched the big chairs. They felt cool. The fringed velvet portières were smooth. I had known that room now for 2 weeks, but somehow I felt its character for the first time that night. I walked over to the open window and drank in the beauty and tranquility of the evening. Kurt returned. For a few seconds we stood next to each other, not saying a word. He must have guessed that my thoughts were of home. I felt painfully alone and forlorn in that house, which so closely resembled that of my childhood, in a country so much like my own, standing next to a man who was so much like my family. Yet nothing there belonged to me. Did Kurt sense all my thoughts? Did he feel as I did? I felt his arm around my shoulder, shielding me from my loneliness. His touch electrified me. It was the first affectionate gesture I had received in so many years. I was so starved for affection and protection that the touch of his arm brought tears to my eyes. Kurt pulled me closer and held me, stroking my hair. He did not tell me to stop. He held me tight and let me cry. Suddenly I remembered Abek. He had said we would cry when we met again and understand each other's tears and pain. I looked up at Kurt, trying to form words with quivering lips. He put his finger to my lips. He did not want me to say what he knew would hurt me. Through my tears I could see that he was smiling, that his eyes looked gently and with understanding into mine. Those gentle eyes, that generous, smiling mouth, where had I seen them before? Long ago, in a dream, in Bolkenhain. I buried my face on his chest, feeling safe and at peace at last. Kurt walked me back to the hospital. For a long time I could not sleep. I thought once again about going home. If I did, would I see Kurt again? I resolved firmly to make a decision soon. I would talk it over with Kurt in the morning. I promised myself. He would know how to advise me. Sunday morning we walked through meadows in which the countless buttercups and daisies seemed as fresh and well-scrubbed as the peasants whom we had seen walking to church. Kurt tried to take pictures of me, but I did not let him. I danced over the grass, jumped just when he was ready to snap. He was annoyed, but laughed. We climbed a little hill and sat under a majestic tree. As we talked, I regarded Kurt with wonder and some bewilderment. He was gay and teasing. Was he the same man who held me in his arms the night before? Were those the same lips that had kissed away my tears? Was it only last night? It seemed so remote. Perhaps it had been a dream. Yes, it must have been a dream. For no reason at all, I was afraid that he might try to kiss me now. I sat rigid. Kurt noticed my silence. There was concern in his voice when he asked if I felt well. Then I told him what I had been thinking the night before about going home. He became serious at once. I would not advise you to go before you hear from your uncle in Turkey. He might have news for you about your family. I should have a reply from him soon. Besides, no matter what you may think, you are in no condition to leave the hospital yet. A journey home is not a matter of getting on a train. It would mean hardship and hitchhiking. There is no transportation yet for civilians. It was good to hear him speak of such things as hardships. A few weeks ago they would have been dreamlike luxuries. I listened earnestly, glad that he was offering me a reasonable excuse for delay, glad that he did not say what he must know, that I was afraid to go home. When we returned to the hospital, Kurt's jeep and driver were waiting. I asked Kurt to come to my room for a moment. There I gave him the 8 essays that I had written for him. He read the inscription on the first page of the crudely bound booklet. To Kurt, a few episodes from my life, Goethe. It's your birthday present, I told him. He caught my hands and exclaimed, It's the nicest present I've ever gotten or ever will get. A few hours after Kurt left, I walked to the cemetery, a quarter mile or so away. Most of the old graves with Czech names were not tended, though some had fresh flowers on them. One corner of the yard had a large number of new graves. After some hunting, I came upon Liesel's grave. My knees felt weak. I sat down. Here, near me, was Liesel, who could laugh like silver bells on a sleigh. Liesel, whose dreams I knew, with whom I had played pretend about the future. I could hardly believe that she was there, her supple movements stilled forever. After a time I went to find Sousa's grave. There, too, I put flowers, whispering her name. The sound was strange in the stillness, and again I felt terribly alone. Remembering Ilse buried somewhere under a tree, I knew that I must get away from the dead, away from the past, away from my thoughts. I had a future to face. Would my memories haunt me forever? I made two decisions as I walked slowly back to the hospital. First, I would find out how well I was. Some of Kurt's words had made me wonder if perhaps I was not aware of something I should know. Second, I would not go home until I could know for sure whether my parents and Arthur would be there. Along with everyone in the hospital, I had added my name to a list to be published in Sosnowiec, in Bielitz, and in all other towns where there had been Jews before the war. After my name was the information that I was looking for Papa, Mama, and Arthur, Abeg, his people, and Ilse's family. How long would it be before some news would reach me? Again, I must push the days ahead and wait to be certain. My conference with my doctor was inconclusive. "You are as well as can be expected," he answered. Then he corrected himself. "As well as no one dared to hope for. We will take more x-rays in a couple of days and give you a thorough examination after you are off medication. You say that you would like to occupy your mind and hands. This is a very welcome sign. You may, if you wish, help in the office and lab. I shall show you how to make simple tests, label bottles, distribute medicines. But you should not work a lot, and you must get as much fresh air and sunshine as possible for your lungs."
"My lungs, doctor?"
"Well, pneumonia and the exposure to TB. The sleeping in the snow did not exactly help." "I want the truth," I insisted. "There is nothing wrong with you as far as I know," he repeated. "But I don't know the whole truth yet myself. If I were you, I would not push my good luck too far." I let it go at that. About a week after Kurt had left, another captain from the military government came to see me. He came quietly to the point. "You are leaving for Bavaria tomorrow." I stared at him. "You are going to Freising to Kurt." A number of questions jumped into my mind, but I only said, "I am not going." Exasperated, seeing that he would have to do a lot of explaining, he pulled up a chair. "When Kurt was here last week, he came to see me. There has been talk that our division might withdraw from here. We might be replaced, or perhaps this zone will belong to the Russians. Kurt made me promise that I would bring you to safety if we should withdraw. We have our orders to leave. I will take you to Bavaria tomorrow."
"How about the other girls?" I asked.
"We have been thinking about that. We are trying to work out an arrangement whereby the girls, who are well, can, if they wish, go to Bavaria. For those who remain, we shall try to maintain the hospital as long as the American occupation is here." Troubled by this new development, I spoke to a number of girls about the prospect of going to Bavaria. Many were willing to go, and I learned that some girls whom I had known in Grünberg were supposed to be in Kamm. Kamm was in Bavaria and quite close to Volory. The girl who gave me this information said she would join me if I should decide to go there. Her name was Mala Orbach, and I had struck up an acquaintance with her as a result of her knowing a boy who was stationed with Kurt. The possibility of finding some of my friends in Kamm and of learning about others, perhaps of my family, made my decision easy in the end. I would not go to Kurt, but I would go to Kamm, and there I would decide what next. That night I went to bid the Nabels goodbye. They were sorry to see me go, and gave me some lovely presents, some underwear and a kerchief, as well as an address of some of their relatives who lived in Bavaria near the Swiss border. They urged me to try to keep in touch with them. I spent a sleepless night. In a sense, I hated to leave Volery. There were so many pleasant memories here, in spite of the tragic ones. When I awoke, I had an excited feeling of anticipation of adventure. I also felt buoyant and exhilarated and deeply touched by the thought that Kurt should care so much about my safety. When the military government captain returned for his answer, I informed him that I was going, not to Freising, but to Calm. That was all right with him. I sought out my doctor. After giving me a favorable report on my latest X-rays, he handed me my discharge papers from the hospital. With it was an envelope as well. "What is it?" I asked. "Your wages," he said. "My wages?" "Yes, of course, for working in the lab," he said in a matter-of-fact voice. I understood and was grateful. I did not have a penny of my own. Later, when I opened the envelope, I found a sum many times over the amount I felt my help had been worth. I packed the few clothes I had, a prayer book that had been given me, my collection of snapshots, Kurt's letter, a few books, a couple of sheets of stationery, and some pencil stumps. All my worldly goods. For one fleeting moment, I wondered what I would do if it turned cold or started to rain. I didn't own a coat or sweater, but I quickly dismissed the thought. It was the end of July, and the weather was fine. Then I laughed a bit at myself, thinking how I had slept out in the snow not so very long ago. Chapter 4. Late in the afternoon, Mala Orbach and I arrived in Calm by jeep after having driven over bomb-damaged roads. The captain was anxious to get back to Volery. It was not safe to drive after dark, so he left us in the center of town at the headquarters of the military government. The American sentry told us where we might find other refugees, but when we went to that address, nobody seemed to know about the girls we were seeking. However, they had heard that some girls who had been in a Silesian camp were living on the outskirts of town. Our hopes thus spurred, Mala and I decided to look for them. We were given directions and soon found ourselves in a narrow cobbled street. It was almost dark when we knocked at a modern-looking glass-topped door that seemed rather out of place in such a medieval street. We knocked several times before a woman with curlers in her hair stuck her head through an open window. "What do you want?" she yelled. We explained our mission. "Those girls left yesterday." She closed the window. "Can we stay here overnight?" I called, but either she did not hear or would not answer us. We did not know where to go. We were tired. It had been a long, eventful, trying day. It was completely dark now, and the town was strange. People were suspicious. Skeletons of bombed-out buildings stood like ghosts against the dark sky. Germany was a haunted country, still hostile in defeat. We stood alone among the ruins. I longed for the hospital, for a bed to sleep in, for people I knew. Where should we go? A bell rang the half hour. That was it. There was a church nearby. We found it easily, its steeple outlined in the moonlight, towering over the beaten city. The heavy wooden church door opened slowly. One light was burning near the altar. We lay down on a bench and used our bundles as pillows. I woke up feeling cold. The stained glass windows were lighting with dawn. What a strange 24 hours it had been, my first day of real freedom. I had created a happy world of make-believe around me during the long years of loneliness, a world of beauty and love. It had helped me to survive this lovely world that was to be mine when the war was over. Now the war was over. The silence in the church made me realize how alone I still was, in a strange town where I found refuge in a church at whose altar I did not pray. "Papa, Mama," I murmured the words to hear their sound again, help me find my way." A ray of sun touched the corner of one of the stained glass windows. "Kurt, He would understand and not think my dreams foolish. He would understand the world I created. I would go to him. We hitchhiked from early morning till afternoon. When Mala and I finally arrived in Freising, near Munich, we went straight to the military government building. Just as we started up the broad stone steps, I saw Kurt coming down, hurrying, taking two steps at a time. He embraced us.
I was just on my way to Calm to get you. The captain told me that he had left you there. Everything's ready. I have a room in Munich for you and Mala, and when you are ready to work, it will be easier to get a job in Munich than here in Freising.
Kurt's jeep halted on the outskirts of Munich near the Perlacher Forest just before nightfall. A few scattered villas bordered its edge, and there, set in a lovely garden, was the house in which we were to stay. An elderly woman opened the door and led us to our room. She informed us that her husband was in the hospital. Her only son was probably a prisoner of war since he was with the Wehrmacht, and that the upstairs of the house was already occupied by two women whose home had been destroyed by bombs. I wanted to talk to Kurt and was glad when Frau Bieber, our landlady, left us alone. "I must get a job soon," I said. "Do you think I could start looking tomorrow?" Kurt suggested that I should rest for a while first, but I remained firm, and before he left, he had promised to take me to the offices of the Civilian Censorship Division, which was hiring people who had been anti-Nazi. Next afternoon, he took us to the offices of the Civilian Censorship Division, where we applied for jobs and were interviewed by a charming and most understanding WAC captain. She said that we would have to take a 2-week training course, after which we could start working. The job would pay well and give me the independence I longed for. Kurt stayed on in Munich that second day and came to see me after dinner. We went walking in the woods behind the house. He was strangely silent, and so was I. Then we started to talk about our parents. For the first time since I had known him, he spoke with bitterness of what had happened to them and of his inability to save them. We sat near a pile of broken branches, and he held one in his hands and systematically began to break it. His knuckles were white with the effort, as if he wanted to break something more. "My brother told me later," he continued, "that after my father had put me on the boat for America, he said, 'I have a feeling I shall not see my boy again.'" I felt my eyes fill with tears. I understood so well what Kurt must feel, remembering Papa's and Mama's reactions when Arthur left. Kurt dropped the branch and took my hand silently. We sat in the dusk in silence, understanding each other better than if we had spoken 1,000 words. We had started back toward the house without saying a word when several shots echoed through the woods. I stopped, petrified, expecting to hear screams and the rat-tat-ta of more shouts, but the forest was silent. No more sound came. My heart beat fast, my temples pounded. I felt tears in my eyes, and I started to tremble. Kurt removed his jacket and put it around my shoulders.
"You're dressed much too lightly," he remarked, pretending not to know why I was trembling.
I felt the strength and protection of his arm around me and smiled at him. Early the next morning, I resolved to go back to the forest to get used to being unafraid. It was difficult, and I trembled every time the branches rustled. Then I thought I spotted something red beneath the evergreens. Drops of blood. No, they were berries. I forced myself to touch them. They were only berries, but I could not make myself eat them. After my training period, I began working for the Civilian Censorship Division, reading confiscated Nazi mail. I often visited the German Museum, which now housed a multitude of displaced persons. There, too, were the offices of UNRRA, where daily were posted the names of people who had survived and were looking for their kin. I would scan the lists, hoping to find a familiar name. Day after day, I would walk away frustrated. Once I met some people from Sosnowiec, and they told me that all of Abek's family was gone, and that they had heard that Abek had died. I did not believe them then. I did not want to hear such news, but later it was to be confirmed. I told Kurt about my visits to the museum. "You should not go constantly," he said. "Why do you torture yourself like this?" I could not seem to tell him why. One Sunday in mid-August, I was lying on the grass behind our house, looking up to the cloudless sky. Long, long ago, I had known countless such afternoons as this. Just then, Kurt came, shouting, "The war with Japan is over!" He pulled a bottle from his pocket. "Anisette," he said, "we'll drink to peace." Ashamed to admit that I had never in my life tasted alcohol, I ran into the house for some glasses. We drank to peace, and drank to peace again. "I'm dizzy," I told Kurt, sitting down on the grass.
"So am I," Kurt said.
Somehow it seemed screamingly funny. I burst into laughter, and then I was in his arms. With that kiss, I felt as if I could fly through the air with the sheer power of happiness, settle on the clouds, kiss the stars, dance on the moon, and love the whole world. Several days later, Kurt brought me the long-awaited letter from Turkey. I held it for a moment before opening it, exalted and happy in the knowledge that my uncle was alive, that there was at least one member of my family left. When I finally tore it open, I read of my uncle's joy at finding me, of his willingness and eagerness to help me do whatever I wanted. The warm bond of my family's love was about me again, but the information that I had asked for and prayed that he might be able to provide, he couldn't give me. Instead, he asked me about Papa, Mama, Arthur. Now at last I knew that I would never go home again. A few weeks passed. Then came September 13th, a Thursday. As I was coming home from work, I saw Kurt. I was surprised, not having expected to see him till Sunday. "Goethe," he said after the preliminaries were over, "I'm going home." I managed to say, "I'm so glad for you," and then I felt tears coming.
"Is this all you have to say to me?" Kurt demanded. "I want you to come to America and be my wife." He gently took my face in his hands. He looked into my eyes and said, "Don't you understand? I love you. I want to marry you." I clung to Kurt, speechless with happiness as words of tenderness poured from his lips. Later, we discussed practical matters. He had two alternatives. He could stay another year or two in the occupation forces, and we could be married at once, or he could go home and send for me as soon as the consulates were in operation again. It would be harder on me that way, but I would be out of Germany sooner. Kurt insisted that the decision was to be mine, but I read his hope in his eyes. "Go home," I whispered. He nodded. "That way it will be better for our future." That night in my room I faced my fear of being alone again, my fear of losing Kurt as I had lost everyone else I ever loved. This time there would be a separation, even a long separation, but I knew there would be no loss. "Kurt," I called into the night. "Kurt, I love you." And there, through the night, through the stars, through the sky, through the leaves and the trees, through the magic of life itself, I felt my cry answered. Wherever Kurt was, his thought met mine. I let the joy that rose to my heart take possession of my being. I had reached the summit, as I had dreamed I would in the dark years of slavery, and there, beyond the sphere of human vision, we met and embraced. We would never be alone again. Epilogue. It is with trepidation that I look back at what I wrote nearly half a century ago in the springtime of my life. A welter of emotions assails me and must be sorted out. Now that I have reached autumn, perhaps I can be more objective. I have been asked countless times, how and why did you go on during those unspeakable years? And then, how do you cope with the memory of hardships